any he could find. The day was all a mystery to Nutt, and it stayed a mystery, becoming a little more mysterious with every passing minute. In the distance, a whistle was blown, and somewhere in this moving, jostling, crushing, and in most cases drinking mob of people, there was a game going on, apparently. He had to take Trev's word for it. There were oohs and ahs in the distance, and the crowd ebbed and flowed in response. Trev and his chums, who called themselves, as far as Nutt could make out over the din, the Dimwell Massive Pussy, took advantage of every temporary space to move nearer and nearer to the mysterious game, holding their ground when the press went against them, and pushing hard when an eddy went their way. Push, sway, shove. And something in this spoke to Nutt. It came up through the soles of his feet and the palms of his hands, and slid into his brain with a beguiling subtlety, warming him, stripping him away from himself, and leaving him no more than a beating part of the living, moving thing around him. A chant came past. It had started somewhere at the other end of the game, and whatever it had been once, it was now just four syllables of roar from hundreds of people and many gallons of beer. As it faded, it took the warm, belonging feeling away with it, leaving a hole. Nutt looked into the eyes of Trev.
"Happened you did it," Trev said. "That was quick."
"It was..." Nutt began.
"I know. We don't talk about it," said Trev, flatly.
"But it spoke to me without..."
"We don't talk about it, okay? Not that sort of thing. Look, they're being pushed back. It's opening up. Let's shove."
And Nutt was good at shoving. Very good. Under his inexorable pressure, people slid or gently spun out of the way, their hobnailed boots scraping on the stones as, short of an alternative, the owners were rolled and squeezed alongside Nutt and Trev and deposited behind them, somewhat dizzy, bewildered and angry. Now, though, there was a frantic tugging at Nutt's belt.
"Stop pushing," Trev shouted. "We've left the others behind."
"In fact, my progress is now hindered by a peas pudding and chowder stand. I have been doing my best, Mr. Trev, but it has really been slowing me down," said Nutt over his shoulder. "And also Miss Glenda."
"Hello, Miss Glenda."
Trev glanced behind him. There was a fight going on back there, and he could hear Andy's battle cry. There was generally a fight going on around Andy, and if there wasn't, he started one.
"But you had to like Andy because..."
"Well, you just had to."
"He..." Glenda was up ahead. Surely that meant that she would be there too.
There was a commotion further on, and a vaguely oblong thing, wrapped now in tatters of cloth, rose up in the air and fell back, to cheers and catcalls from the crowd. Trev had been right up to the game face many times before. It was no big deal. He'd seen the ball dozens of times. But how long had Nutt been pushing a pudding stall in front of him like a snowplough? "Oh my," Trev thought, "I've found a player. How can he do it? He looks half-starved all the time." In the absence of any way round in the press of people, Trev scrambled between Nutt's legs and for a moment looked down an avenue of coat hems, boots, and, right in front of him, a pair of legs that were considerably more attractive than those of Nutt. He surfaced a few inches away from the milky blue eyes of Juliet. She did not look surprised. Surprise is an instant thing, and by the time Juliet could register surprise, she generally wasn't. Glenda, on the other hand, was the kind of person who instantly whacks surprise on the meat slab of indignation and hammers it into fury, and as their gazes locked and metaphorical bluebirds cleared their throats for the big number, she appeared between them and demanded, "What the hells were you doing down there, Trevor Likely?" The bluebirds evaporated. "What are you doing up front here?" said Trev. It wasn't repartee, but it was the best he could do now with his heart pounding.
"We got shoved," growled Glenda. "You lot were shoving us."
"Me? I never did," said Trev indignantly.
"It was..." He hesitated. "Nutt?" Look at him standing there, all nervous and skinny, like he's never had a good meal in his life.
"I wouldn't believe me, and I am me."
"It was them behind," he said lamely.
"Trolls with big boots on, were they?" said Glenda, her voice all vinegar. "We'd be in the game if it wasn't for Mr. Nutt here holding you all back."
The unfairness of this took Trev aback, but he decided to stay there rather than argue with Glenda. Nutt could do no wrong in her eyes, and Trev could do no right, which he couldn't contest, but rather felt should be amended to never did any serious wrong. But there was Juliet smiling at him. When Glenda looked away to talk to Nutt, she slipped something into his hand, and then turned her back on him as if nothing had happened.
Trev opened his hand, heart pounding, and there was a little enamel badge in black and white, the colours of the hated enemy. It was still warm from her hand. He closed his hand quickly and looked around to see if anyone had spotted this betrayal of all that was good and true, i.e. the good name of Dimwell. Supposing he got knocked down by a troll and one of the lads found it on him. Supposing Andy found it on him. But it was a gift from her. He put it into his pocket and rammed it down to the bottom. This was going to be really difficult, and Trev was not a man who liked problems in his life. The owner of the pudding stand, having enterprisingly sold a number of portions to passing trade during its journey, strolled up to Trev and offered him a bag of hot peas.
"Tough mate you got there," he said. "Some kind of troll, is he?"
"Not troll, a goblin," said Trev, as the sounds of the strife drew nearer.
"I thought they were little buggers."
"This one isn't," said Trev, wishing the man would go away. There was a sudden, localised silence, the kind of noise made by people who are holding their breath. He looked up and saw the ball for the second time in the game. There was a core of ash wood in there somewhere, then a leather skin, and finally dozens of layers of cloth for grip, and it was dropping with pinpoint inevitability towards the beautiful, dreamy head of Juliet. Trev dived at her without a moment's thought, dragging her under the cart as the ball thumped onto the cobbles where she had been gracing the world with her presence. Many things went through Trev's mind as the ball hit the ground. She was in his arms, even if she was complaining about getting mud on her coat. He had probably saved her life, which from a romantic point of view was money in the bank, and, oh yes, Dimmer or Dolly, if one of the hardcore posses found out about this, the next thing to go through his head would be a boot. She giggled.
"Shush," he managed. "Not a good idea if you'd rather not know how you'd look with that beautiful hair shaved off."
Trev peeped out from under the stall and attracted no attention at all. This is because Nut had picked up the ball and was turning it over and over in his hands with a frown on what was visible of, if you were kind, his face.
"Is this all it is?" he said to a bewildered Glenda. "A most inappropriate ending to a pleasant social gathering with interesting canapés. Where is this wretched thing supposed to be, then?"
Glenda, hypnotised by the sight, pointed a wavering finger in the general direction of down the street.
"There's a big pole painted white. Well, spattered with red at the bottom."
"Oh, yes, I see it. Well, in that case, I'll..."
"Look, will you men please stop pushing?" Nut added to the crowd, who were craning to see. "But there's no way you'll ever get it there," Glenda yelled. "Just put it down and come away."
Trev heard a grunt from Nut and absolute silence from the rest of the world. "Oh, no," he thought. "Really, no. It must be more than, what, 150 yards to that goal? And those things fly like a bucket. There is no way that he could..." A distant pock broke the breathless silence, which healed itself instantly. Trev peered over a shoulder as the 60-foot goalpost gave up its battle with termites, rot, weather, gravity and Nut, and fell into its own base in a cloud of dust. He was so astonished that he hardly noticed Juliet standing up next to him. In fact, Juliet's rising from beneath the cart passed relatively unnoticed by all, except an art student who was almost blinded by the light at the spectacle, and many years later painted the picture known as Beauty Arising from the Peas Pudding Cart, attended by cherubs carrying hot dogs and pies. It was widely regarded as a masterpiece, although no one could ever work out exactly what the hell it was all about. But it was beautiful, and so it was true.
"Is that a kind of, like, sign?" said Juliet, who believed in such things.
At that moment, Trev believed in pointing a finger towards the other side of the street and shouting, "He went that way!" and then hauling Juliet upright and butting Nut in the stomach.
"Let's go," he added.
He couldn't do anything about Glenda, but that would not matter. While he held Juliet's hand, Glenda would follow him like a homing vulture. People were trying to run towards the hidden goal. Others were making for the apparent location of the long-distance scorer. Trev pointed in a random direction and yelled,
"He went down there! Big man with a black hat!"
Confusion always helped when it wasn't yours. When it was time for a hue and cry, make sure who was Hugh. They halted a few alleys away. There was still a commotion far off, but a city crowd is easier to get lost in than a forest.
"Look, perhaps I should go back and apologise," Nut began. "I could make a new poll quite easily."
"I hate to tell you this, Gobbo, but I think you might have upset the kind of people who don't listen to apologies," said Trev.
Keep moving, everyone.
Why might they be upset?
Well, Mr. Nutt, first, you are not supposed to score a goal when it is not your game, and anyway, you are a watcher, not a player, said Glenda. And second, a shot like that gets right up people's noses. You could have killed someone.
No, Miss Glenda, I assure you I could not. I deliberately aimed at the pole.
So? That doesn't mean you were sure to hit it.
I have to say it does, Miss Glenda, he mumbled.
How did you do it? You took the pole to bits. They don't grow on trees. You'll get us all into trouble.
Why can't he be a player? Said Juliet, staring at her reflection in the window.
What? Said Glenda.
Bloody hell, said Trev. With him on the team, you wouldn't need a team.
That'd save a lot of trouble, then, said Juliet.
So you say, said Glenda. And where would be the fun in that? That wouldn't be football any more.
We are being watched, said Nutt. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Trev glanced around. The street was busy, but mostly with its own affairs.
There's no one interested, Gobbo. We're well away.
I can feel it on my skin, Nutt insisted.
What, through all that wool? Said Glenda.
He turned round, soulful eyes on her.
Yes, he said, and remembered Ladyship testing him on that. It had seemed like a game at the time.
He glanced up, and a large head drew back quickly from a parapet. There was a very faint smell of bananas.
Ah, that one. He was nice.
Nutt saw him sometimes, going hand over hand along the pipes.
"You ought to get her home," said Trev to Glenda.
Glenda shuddered.
"Not a good idea. Old Stollop will ask her what she saw at the game."
"Well, she'll tell him.
And who she saw.
Can't she lie?"
"Not in the way you can, Trev. She's just no good at making stuff up. Look, let's get back to the university. We all work there, and I often go in to catch up. We'll go directly now, and you two go back the long way. We never saw one another, right? And for heaven's sake, don't let him do anything silly."
"Excuse me, Miss Glenda," said Nutt meekly.
"Yes, what?
Which of us were you addressing?"
"I have let you down," said Nutt, as they strolled through the post-match crowds. At least, Trev ambled. Nutt moved with a strange gait that suggested there was something wrong with his pelvis.
"Nah, it's fixable," said Trev. "Everything is fixable. I'm a fixer, me. What did anybody really see? Just a bloke in dimmer kit. There's thousands of us. Don't worry."
How come you're so tough, Gobbo? You spent your life lifting weights, or what?"
"You are correct in your surmise, Mr. Trev. Before I was born, I did indeed used to lift weights. I was only a child then, of course." They strolled on, and after a while, Trev said,
"Could you say that again? It's got stuck in my head. Actually, I think part of it's sticking out of my ear."
"Ah, yes, perhaps I have confused you. There was a time when my mind was full of darkness. Then Brother Oates helped me to the light, and I was born."
"Oh, religion stuff.
But here I am. You asked why I am strong. When I lived in the dark of the forge, I used to lift weights. The tongs at first, and then the little hammer, and then the biggest hammer, and then one day I could lift the anvil. That was a good day. It was a little freedom."
"Why was it so important to lift the anvil?"
"I was chained to the anvil."
They walked on in silence again until Trev, picking each word with care, said,
"I guess things must be sort of tough in the high country."
"It is not so bad now, I think."
"Makes you count your blessings, that sort of thing."
"The presence of a certain lady, Mr. Trev?"
"Yeah, since you ask. I think about her all the time. I really like her. But she's a dolly."
A small group of supporters turned to glance at them, and he lowered his voice to a hiss.
"She's got brothers with fists the size of a bull's arse."
"I have read, Mr. Trev, that love laughs at locksmiths."
"Really? And what does it do when it's been smacked in the face by a bull's arse?"
"The poets are not forthcoming in that respect, Mr. Trev."
"Besides," said Trev, "locksmiths tend to be quiet blokes, you know. Careful and patient and that, like you. I reckon you could get away with a bit of a joke. You must have met girls. I mean, you know oil painting, that's a fact, but they like a posh voice. I bet you had 'em eaten out of your hand.
Well, after you'd washed it, obviously."
Nutt hesitated. There had been Ladyship, of course, and Miss Heelstether, neither of whom fitted easily into the category of girl. Of course, there were the little sisters, who were certainly young and apparently female, but it had to be said looked rather like intelligent chickens, and certainly weren't seen at their best when you watched them feeding. But once again, girls did not seem the right word.
"'I have not met many girls,' he volunteered. "'There's Glenda. She's taken a real shine to you. Watch out, though. She'll run your life for you if you let her. It's what she does. She does it to everyone.'
"'You two have a history, I think,' said Nut.
"'You are a sharp one, aren't you? Quiet and sharp, like a knife. Yeah, I suppose it was a history. I wanted it to be more of a geography, but she kept slapping my hand.'
Trev paused to search for any flicker in Nut's face.
"'That was a joke,' he added, without much hope.
"'Thank you for telling me, Mr. Trev. I will decipher it later.'
Trev sighed.
"'But I ain't like that any more. And Juliet, well, I'd crawl a mile over broken glass just to hold her hand. No funny business.'
"'Writing a poem is often the way to the intended's heart,' said Nut.
Trev brightened. "'Ah, I'm good with words. If I wrote her a letter, you could give it to her, right? If I write it on posh paper, something like, oh, let's see, I think you're really fit. How about a date? No hanky-panky. Promise. Love, Trev. How's that sound?'
"'The soul of it is pure and noble, Mr. Trev, but if I could assist in some way...
"'It needs longer words, right? And more sort of curly language?' said Trev.
But Nut was not paying attention.
"'Sounds lovely to me,' said a voice above Trev's head. "'Who do you know what can read, smart boy?'
There was this to be said about the Stollop brothers. They weren't Andy. It was, in the great scheme of things, not a huge difference when you couldn't see for blood, but, in short, Stollops knew that force had always worked, and so had never bothered to try anything else. Whereas Andy was a stone-cold psychopath who had a following only because it was safer than being in front of him. He could be quite charming when the frantically oscillating mood swing took him. That was the best time to run. As for the Stollops, it would not take long for a researcher to realise that Juliet was the brains of the family outfit. One advantage from Trev's viewpoint was that they thought they were clever, because no one had ever told them otherwise.
"Ha, Mr. So-called Trev," said Billy Stollop, prodding Trev with a finger like a hippopotamus sausage. "You full of smarts. You tell us who broke the goal, right?"
"I was in the shove, Billy. Didn't see a thing."
"Are you going to play for the Dimmers?" Billy persisted.
"Billy, not even your dad at his best could throw the ball half as far as everyone is saying. You know it, right? You couldn't do it. I'm hearing that the Angel's Post just fell apart and someone made up a story. Would I lie to you, Billy?"
Trev could make up lies that were very nearly truths.
"Yeah, 'cause you're a dimmer."
"All right, you got me. I'll come clean," said Trev, holding out his hands. "Respect and all that, Billy. It was Nut here that threw the ball. That's my last offer."
"I ought to smack your head off for that," said Billy, sneering at Nut. "That kid don't look like he could even lift the ball."
And then a voice behind Trev said, "Why, Billy, have they let you out without your collar on?" Nut heard Trev mutter, "Oh, God, and I was doing so well," under his breath. And then his friends turned and said,
"It's a free street, Andy. No, I'm in passing the time, eh?"
"The dolly's killed your old man, Trev. Ain't you got no shame?"
The rest of the massive posse was standing behind Andy, their expressions a mix of defiance and the realisation that, once again, they were going to be dragged into something. They were out in the main streets now. The watch was not inclined to get involved in alley scuffles, but out in the open they had to do something in case the taxpayers complained. And since tired coppers didn't like having to do something, they did it good and hard, so with any luck they wouldn't have to do it again any time soon.
"What do you know about all this they're saying about a dimmer man and a dolly tart holding hands in the shove?" Andy demanded.
He put a heavy hand on Trev's shoulder.
"Come on! You're smart. You always know everything before anyone else." "Tart?"
That was Billy. It was a long way from his ears to his brain.
"There's not a girl in Dolly Sisters who'd look at you, poxy lot." "Ah, so that's where we got it from," said Carter the Farter.
This struck Nut as inflammatory in the circumstances. Perhaps, he thought, the ritual is that childish insults shall be exchanged until both sides feel fully justified in attacking. Just as Dr. von Mausberger noted in Ritual Aggression in Pubescent Rats. But Andy had fished his short cutlass out of his shirt. It was a nasty little weapon, alien to the true spirit of Foot the Ball, which generally smiled indulgently on things that bruised, scared, fractured and, okay, worst case, heat of the moment and so on, blinded. But you'd got another eye, right? And now you had solid proof that you were a hard man, especially if you got one of those scars that run across the eye and down the cheek.
get a black eye patch, and you would never have to wait to be served at a bar ever again. But then came Andy, who had issues. And once you had someone like Andy around you, you got other Andys around too, and every kid who might otherwise have gone to a match with a pair of brass knuckles for bravado noticeably clanked when he walked and needed to be helped up if he fell over. Now weapons were being loosened here too. "Careful now, everyone," Trev cautioned, stepping back and waving his empty hands in a conciliatory way. "This is a busy street, OK? If the old Sam catch you fighting, they'll be down on you with big, big truncheons, and they'll beat you until you onk your breakfast. Because for why? Because they hate you. Because you're making paperwork for them and keeping them out of the donut shop." He stepped back a little further. "And then, on account of you damaging their weapons with your heads, they'll run you down to Tanty for a nice night in the tank. Been there? Was it so much fun you want to go back again?" He noted with satisfaction the looks of dismayed recollection on the faces of all except Nut, who couldn't have any idea, and Andy, who was brother to the tank. But even Andy was not inclined to go up against the Sam. Kill just one of them, and veterinary would give you one chance to see if you could stand on air. They relaxed a little, but not too much. All it took in these sphincter-taut circumstances was one idiot. As it happened, one very clever person was able to do the job when Nut turned to Algernon, the youngest Stollop, and said cheerfully, "Do you know, sir, that your situation here is very similar to that described by von Mausberger in his treatise on his experiment with rats?" At this point, Algernon, after 1 second of what passed for Algernon as thought, whacked him hard with his club. Algernon was a big boy. Trev managed to grab his friend before he hit the cobbles. The club had hit Nut square in the chest and torn the ancient sweater open. Blood was soaking through the stitches. "What did you have to go and hit him for, you bloody fool?" Trev said to Algernon, agreed even by his brothers to be as thick as elephant soup. "He wasn't doing a thing. What was that all about, eh?" He sprang to his feet, and before Algernon could move, Trev had ripped his own shirt off and was ministering to Nut, trying to staunch the wound. He came back up again after half a minute and flung the sodden shirt at Algernon. "There's no heartbeat, you moron. What did he ever do to you?" Even Andy was frozen. No one had ever seen Trev like it. Not old Trev. Even the dollies knew Trev was smart. Trev was slick. Trev wasn't the sort to commit suicide by yelling at a bunch of men who were already tensed for a fight. The luckless Algernon, with Trev's rage baking his face, managed, "But, like, he's a dimmer." "Who are you? You're a bloody fool, that's what you are," screamed Trev. He rounded on the others, finger shaking. "Who are you? Who are you? Nothing. You're rubbish. You're all shite." He jabbed the finger at Nut. "And him? He made stuff. He knew things. And he'd never seen a game before today. He was only wearing a strip to fit in." "Don't you worry, Trev, mate," Andy hissed and raised his cutlass menacingly. "There's gonna be a bloody war about this." But Trev was suddenly in his face like a wasp. "You what? You are mental. You just don't get it, do you?"
"I can see helmets, Andy," said Jumbo urgently.
"Me? What did I do? As much as the stupid Stollops, dimmers and dollies, I hope the god shit thin shit on both of you."
"They're getting really close, Andy."
The Stollop boys, who were not altogether dumb, were already leaving. People in Football Strip were criss-crossing the city. The watch couldn't chase everyone. But, well, belting some bloke who then bled a lot and stopped breathing, well, that was tantamount to murder, and the old Sam could develop quite a turn of speed in those circumstances. Andy shook a furious finger at Trev. "It's a hard life in the shove when you're a dumb chaff with no mates."
"This ain't the shove."
"Better wake up, kid. It's all shove." The posse left at speed, although Jumbo turned for a moment to mouth sorry. They weren't the only ones hurrying off. The street people were all for a free cabaret, but this one might have associated difficulties. For example, the asking of dangerous metaphysical questions such as, "Did you see anything?" and similar. It was all very well for the watch to say, "The innocent have nothing to fear," but what was that all about? Who cared about the innocent and their problems when the watch were on their way? Trev knelt by the cooling body of the late Nut. And now, for the first time in a minute, it seemed to Trev, he started to breathe again.
He had stopped when he had raged at Andy, because if you talked like that to Andy, you were dead anyway, so why waste your breath? There were things you had to do, weren't there? Weren't you supposed to keep banging on the chest to, like, show the broken heart how to beat again? But he didn't know how, and you didn't need much smarts to know that it was not a good idea to try to learn with the watch on its way. It would not give a good first impression. That was why, when two watchmen turned up at speed, Trev was walking unsteadily towards them with Nut in his arms. He was relieved to see that in charge was Constable Haddock. At least he was one of the ones who asked questions first. Behind him, and eclipsing most of the scenery, was Troll Officer Bluejohn, who could clear a whole street just by walking down the centre of it. "Can you help me to get him to the Lady Sybil, Mr. Haddock? He's very heavy," said Trev. Constable Haddock pulled the sodden shirt aside and made a sad little clicking sound. With experience comes familiarity.
"Morg's closer, Ed."
"No!" Haddock nodded.
"You're Dave Lightley's son, ain't you?"
"I don't have to tell you."
"No, because I'm right," said Constable Haddock evenly. "Okay, Trev. Bluejohn here will take this man, who I expect you have never seen before in your life, and we'll both run to keep up. There was a decent thunderstorm the night before last. He might be lucky, and so might you."
"I never did it."
"Course not. And now, let's see who's fastest at running, shall we? The hospital first."
"I want to stay with him," said Trev, as Bluejohn's huge hand gently cradled Nut.
"No, lad," said Haddock. "You stay with me."
It didn't stop with Constable Haddock. It never did. Everyone called him Kipper. And his calm, unspoken message that since we're all in this together, why make it hard for one another, often worked, but soon or later you'd be handed over to a senior copper who manufactured hard, in a little room with another copper at the door. And this one had been working double shifts by the look of her. "I'm Sergeant Angwer, sir, and I hope you are not in trouble." She opened a notebook and smoothed down the page. "Shall we go through the motions? You told Constable Haddock that you saw a fight going on, and when you got there, all the big boys had run away, and, amazingly, you found your workmate, Mr. Nuts, bleeding to death. Well, I bet I can name all the big boys, every last one of them. I wonder why can't you?" "And what, Trevor Likely, is this about?" She flicked a black-and-white enamel token across the table, and by luck or judgment, its pin stuck in the wood a few inches from Trev's hand. The unofficial motto of the Lady Sybil Free Hospital was "Not everybody dies." It was true that, subsequent to the founding of the Lady Sybil, the chances of death from at least some causes in the city were quite amazingly reduced. Its surgeons were even known to wash their hands before operating, as well as after. But moving through its white corridors now was a figure who knew, from personal experience, that the unofficial motto was, in reality, entirely mistaken. Death stood by the well-scrubbed slab and looked down.
"Mr. Nutt, well, this is a surprise," said Death, reaching into his robe. "Let me see what I have here. You know," he said, "I used to wonder why people scrabbled so. After all, compared with the length of infinity, people do not live any time at all. Even you, Mr. Nutt. Although I can see that scrabbling would work a little magic in your case."
"I can't see you," said Nut.
"Just as well," said Death. "You will not remember me, in any case, later on."
"I'm dying then," said Nut.
"Yes, dying and then again living."
He fished out a lifetimer from his robe and watched as the sand fell upwards.
"See you later, Mr. Nut. I fear that you will have an interesting life."
"A dolly favour on a good dimmer, boy. God's bless my soul. I say, what can this be about? And do you know what? I will find out. It's all a matter of shoving." Trev said nothing. He was out of options. Besides, he had seen the sergeant before, and she always seemed to be looking at his throat. "Constable Haddock tells me the Igor's on duty down at the Lady Sybil. I hope he's got a heart in his vats that'll fit your friend, I really do," she said. "But it'll still be a murder case, even if he comes walking in here tomorrow. Lord Vetinari's rules. If it takes an Igor to bring you back, you were dead. Briefly dead, it's true, which is why the murderer will be briefly hanged.
A quarter of a second usually does it.
I didn't touch him.
I know, but you have to keep solid with your mates, right? Jumbo, and of course Carter, and